Please be advised that this serving of AIDS, the Lost Voices, may cause offense or upset, as...
I've got a bit of a potty mouth. I mean, I can't help it. Well, I can help it, but you know, this subject just gets me so fired up that the odd swear word just falls out every now and again. Anyway, if you've got sensitive ears, or you're around people with sensitive ears, then perhaps tune in later. Don't tune in at all. Pop in some headphones. I don't give a f***. Anyway, let's get this show started. Roll it.
AIDS brings a response Life from the government.
AIDS, the disease which claims life.
Welcome to Extra Tea with your camp host, William Hampson.
And my fabulous co-host, Gloria.
Between us, we'll be looking back through the decades at how Britain reported on the AIDS pandemic.
And where we will try to unpick individual stories in the newspaper archives from the 80s, 90s, and noughties.
Ready?
Ready.
All right, let's do it.
Oh, here she is, here she is. Hello.
Hey.
Fizz. I've got to ask. How was your holiday? How was your trip to Clacton-on-Sea?
They've got some gorgeous sandy beaches full of big hairy chests, tattoos, and beer bellies.
And that's just the women, right?
Exactly.
Oh, dear, the power of podcasting and the power of editing, because the listeners won't know that Gloria just went on a massive 4 to 5 minute rant about her time in the gorgeous Clacton-on-Sea. There's nothing wrong with Clacton.
I agree.
And... much of it wasn't broadcastable. Right. Anyway, let's just crack on with the show. Next stop, Bournemouth. See what I did there? See, look, that's another... I recommended Bournemouth and you didn't take me
really?
For Bournemouth. So, next stop, Bournemouth.
You've got nothing on Judith Chalmers.
Bitch, don't pretend you know who Judith Chalmers is. But what I meant was our next stop, literal next stop, is Bournemouth.
Okay.
Where we're looking at the story of a young man named Christopher Egner.
Yes, because the first article we're looking at is from January 22nd, 1985, with the headline, AIDS Man Home. The article reads... An AIDS victim who caused a scare after it was discovered his blood had been used in transfusions has been discharged from the hospital. The Bournemouth man has been asked not to donate any more blood and to avoid sexual relations.
Oh, and we know what's coming, don't we? That the press are going to quickly name, vilify, and stigmatize this young man for giving blood, purely because it turns out that he's now got a HIV/AIDS diagnosis, and also as well, on top, it's not going to help, is the fact that he's a gay man. But, spoiler alert, but don't stick your fingers in your ears, because I want you to hear this. We all know what the press narrative was at the time of the 1980s and 90s, specifically this period of 1984 and 1985, against both the gay population and people that were suspected or had a confirmed diagnosis of HIV and AIDS. Now, there is absolutely nothing to suggest that this young man, like many other people that gave blood, knowingly did so with a HIV/AIDS diagnosis. I think you're going to learn quite the opposite. And it probably didn't even need to be said, but the newspapers are going to write these stories and we're going to read them, and you're perhaps going to get the thoughts that probably many people at the time had. But there's absolutely no evidence he didn't know himself that he was HIV/AIDS positive. So now we've got that out of the way. Let's move on.
It's just the unfortunate reality of how HIV/AIDS was able to go undetected. And there is a sad irony here, isn't there?
There is, in that people that give blood do so to save lives, you know, to be helpful. It's their good charitable deed.
Yeah.
And this man, who we know is Christopher Egner, according to the Guardian newspaper, on the 23rd of February 1985, gave blood 4 times before he fell unwell himself in October 1984.
And I guess there's no way of verifying this?
Well, interestingly for us, we do, from documents that were submitted as evidence to the recent UK Infected Blood Inquiry, where Chris Egner's case of donating blood was referred to as the Wessex donor. And in that evidence submitted, we learn that Chris donated blood for the first time on the 21st of November 1982 in his home city of Hull, which was then sent to Leeds. His donation was sent to Leeds and added to a plasma pool of other donors, but it was never used as it was deemed to be, quote, time-expired plasma, which I believe just means plasma that's at the end of its shelf life.
Ah.
Chris then left his home city of Hull and went to the West Midlands, and while living there temporarily, he donated blood on the 14th of February 1983. Then between February and September of that year, 1983, Chris moved to Bournemouth on the Dorset coast, and he donates blood for a third time in September 1983, then for a fourth time in March 1984, and for a final and fifth time on the 25th of September, 1984.
It's hard to convince someone to give blood once, let alone regularly. It's incredibly unfortunate how things turned out.
Oh, absolutely. And even with this tiny, minuscule insight, we will come to learn more about Chris, and I believe we'll learn enough to understand that he was a kind, caring, compassionate young man that was just doing his good deed in giving blood.
And with that, Chris first appears in the whole Daily Mail on December 10th, 1974.
That's right. So we're going back 10 years in the British newspaper archives to 1974, where Chris is 17 years old and is in his hometown of Hull. Now, the article reads, "Organists give demonstration. This month's meeting of Hull and District Organist Association took the form of a demonstration organ lesson given by Mr. Andrew Leach, organist of Ellowton, I think I pronounced that correctly, Parish Church. His pupils were Christopher Egner, Robert Fords, and Stephen Westaway, who played music by Bach, Mandelson, Karg Ellert, and Floor Peters. A discussion of the demonstration followed with emphasis on the personal interpretation of the pieces." I totally butchered that. Anyway.
So, sounds like Chris is a creative, intelligent, musically gifted young man.
Exactly. He's doing something with his life. He's involved in the church, he's learning the organ, he's playing classical music. And this remains for the remainder of his life, as we'll get to hear a little later on.
Awesome.
But he goes on to work as an office manager and is often described as a computer programmer. And this is during the 1980s when computers were relatively new.
And all around nice guy.
Oh, absolutely. You know, he's a nice guy. He's doing something with his life. And interestingly, through his blood donation record that was submitted to the Infected Blood Inquiry, we get to learn his movements around the UK. And between November 1982 and February 1983, Chris has left Hull and is living in the West Midlands. By September 1983, Chris is now living in Bournemouth, working as an office manager and as an organist at his local church.
This is where Chris appears in newspapers up and down the country the following year on April 28th, 1984.
That's right, and you'd be forgiven if you're exaggerating, but you're not, because Chris is mentioned in almost every newspaper up and down the land.
Yeah.
Regionals, nationals, tabloids, you name it, he's in
wow.
it. The Evening Echo gives us the best insight, which runs the headline, "Marathon Musician Will Pull Out All the Stops." And the article reads, "Organist Chris Egner will be pulling out all the stops when he takes part in an organ marathon in Bournemouth tomorrow. He is attempting to play all the tunes in the ancient and modern hymn book during the marathon at St. Swithin's Church, Bournemouth, in aid of church repairs. Quote, I have not counted them, but I believe it is something like 700, said Chris, who is the church organist. He takes his seat at the electric-free manual Father Willis organ at 9 a.m. and hopes to finish his long playing record late in the afternoon. Anybody wanting to sponsor Chris of Albemarle Road, Bournemouth, at half a pence a tune can do so through Vicar, the Reverend Richard Smith."
Chris is clearly one of life's good guys, and it's sad because I know why we're here discussing him today. But on the positive note, see what I did there?
Yes, very clever.
Do we know how much he raised from the organ marathon?
Yes, we do, because the day after, on the 28th of April 1984, the Sun on Sunday reported Chris raised £500.
Wow.
Which, according to the Bank of England, would be around today £1,578.
Awesome.
So, well done, Chris. That's
awesome.
Going.
Well
yes,
done, Chris.
Well done. Brilliant, fabulous. But after the organ marathon, 6 months later, Chris came to be admitted to the Royal National Hospital in Bournemouth on or around the 2nd of October 1984. One of the documents submitted to the blood inquiry, DHS C0001111, shares how Chris became to be admitted, where it reads, "A donor was admitted to Bournemouth Hospital with a skin rash consistent with Kaposi sarcoma, leukemia and anemia. Biopsy results awaited. Donor admits to homosexual activity."
Ah, poor guy. It sounds like the hospital is suspecting an HIV/AIDS diagnosis.
Sadly, yes. And this is where the doctors ask Chris if he's recently given blood, to which he says he has. And this sees the doctors immediately recall his donation that was pulled with many other donations to make a batch of factor VIII, which is commonly used by haemophiliacs, numbered HL3186.
Okay.
And while that's all ongoing, on the 12th of October 1984, Deputy Medical Director Dr. Barnes confirms the biopsy taken from Chris to be KS, Kaposi sarcoma.
No.
Now, plasma from Chris tested positive also for HTVL3, now known as HIV, and Chris is now suffering from PCP, the AIDS-related pneumonia we've spoken about before called pneumocystis carini pneumonia.
I guess Chris is going to be in the hospital for quite some time.
That's right, and we know it wasn't uncommon for men and women to fall ill with these mysterious illnesses to then receive a diagnosis while they're in hospital of HIV or AIDS, and are there for a period, not just many weeks, but often many months. Mm. And it's only through the evidence put before the Infected Blood Inquiry that we get to see what's going on behind the scenes with the recall of this batch of Factor VIII while Chris is trying to get back to some form of reasonable health,
yeah,
now knowing that he's with an HIV/AIDS diagnosis in hospital. And the batch of Factor VIII, where Chris's donation was contributed to a pool of other donors, went on to be sent to the Cardiff and Wessex area and administered to some haemophiliac patients. Now, a total of 885 vials in those areas was distributed to several hospitals and medical facilities to treat haemophilia.
And these are the days before sending out a group email.
Yes, it's going to be slow, isn't it, sending letters to people or perhaps even faxes, because it's not going to be as instant as it would be today to tell people to stop using this batch and to send it back. And we see this being played out in the evidence that was submitted to the Infected Blood Inquiry. Now, some of the communications, just to name just a few of the people that were involved, that just shows you how many kind of elements there were to, you know, recalling this batch of contaminated Factor VIII. Letters were sent to the BPL, which is the Blood Products Laboratory, PHLS, the Public Health Laboratory Services, the National Blood Transfusion Service, and the Wessex Regional Health Authority, to name just a few. Now, some of those with authority in those communications advise for upfront honesty with patients who may possibly now be infected with HIV from this contaminated batch. Others recommend saying nothing and discreetly observing the patients at risk, and one communication shares his concern of the press getting hold of the story, of which they did on the 20th of December 1984. One of the first stories to appear in the press is that of a mother and baby who have both tested positive for HIV.
That is sad.
At least 40 people in Britain have been treated with blood or a clotting agent contaminated with the AIDS virus, and four of them, including a newborn baby, are known to have been infected with the disease. It's the first time the virus has spread through blood donated in this country.
On the 21st of December 1984, in the Sandwell Evening Mail, the headline reads, "Check on mum, child in AIDS risk alert." And the article states, "Doctors are keeping close checks on a Midland mother and her newborn baby who are threatened with AIDS from blood donated by a sufferer of the killer disease. They are among 42 people found to have antibodies linked with AIDS in their blood in the first cases of the virus being transmitted in blood donated in the United Kingdom." Not strictly true, but... "The baby born 6 weeks prematurely just over a month ago is now being monitored in hospital. The mother, who is not being named, is back at home after a normal delivery and is said to be fine. Doctors were alerted when a blood donor from the Bournemouth area was diagnosed as having AIDS. The mother became infected when she received a transfusion from the male donor who gave blood in Birmingham in February 1983. She later became pregnant," not quite accurate by the way, you'll come to learn a little later on.
Okay.
"She later became pregnant and doctors believed the antibodies associated with AIDS were passed passively from her to the child. Dr. Feridun Allah, director of the West Midlands Regional Blood Transfusion Service, said the mother and child did not have the disease, but there was a danger because the virus's incubation period was not known. Blood donors are to be asked by the government not to make donations if they are at, quote, high risk of developing AIDS. Leaflets will be sent to all donors in the wake of the news that more than 50 people in Britain, including a mother and her baby, are at risk from the disease after receiving blood or blood products from two infected donors. The alert follows news that blood from an AIDS sufferer in Bournemouth and another in Scotland has been used to make blood products or for blood transfusions. Dr. Donald Aikson, the government's chief medical officer, said blood from the Bournemouth donor had been given to a mother living in Birmingham and two Wessex men, aged 78 and 40. The woman later gave birth and tests showed that she, her baby and the two men all had been exposed to the AIDS virus. None had shown any signs of the disease. The mother is having her blood regularly checked, but she is not being told why. West Midlands Health Authority said, if the mother does not develop the disease, she will have been spared months of worry.
And from the end of that article, the doctor also said in the Birmingham Mail on February 12, 1985, "With all the press reports, it's a miracle she has not realized yet, but we believe it would impose an unnecessary anxiety on her particularly, as there's nothing we can do about it anyway."
Oh, do you know, I'm so glad that you mentioned that, because this just blew my mind. Mm. This Dr. Feridun Allah, who's still alive, says, quote, "There's nothing we can do about it anyway."
No way.
Hello? How about protecting her husband, her partner, or exactly. her baby's daddy, or any sexual partners
yeah.
from becoming infected themselves? Because in 1984, 1985, they kept banging on and they knew that HIV/AIDS was transmitted through sexual contact. Hmm. And the other thing is as well, which a lot of people talked about when they gave evidence in the infected blood inquiry, whether they remained anonymous or open. What if, because she's had a transfusion, she feels that when she's well enough, she wants to give something back.
Good point.
She wants to return the favour. Mm. And she trots off down to the blood bank and gives blood herself when she's infected with HIV and AIDS. So not telling her really is incredibly dangerous and risky. It just blew my mind. Anyhow, rant over. The mother and baby remain unnamed, but document BPLL00016023 submitted to the inquiry details how the mother came to receive Chris's blood donation that he made on the 14th of February 1983 while living in the West Midlands. And it states, quote, "Recipient female aged 23, transfused for tubular pregnancy, baby born prematurely, baby antibody HIV positive at 6 weeks, mother antibody HIV positive."
But how did they confirm it was Chris's donation that caused the infection?
Well, really, in a nutshell, they can't. Only that, just by the fact Chris gave blood that this woman received, because they've got all the log numbers and they track the donation, he tests positive for HIV a year later, as does the woman who's received this blood. But in all the newspaper articles and the documents submitted to the Infected Blood Inquiry, not one of them mentions nor expresses concern for her, the woman, passing it to her baby's father, her partner, fiancé, husband, boyfriend, whatever he's called. He's just not mentioned at all. Where is he?
That's an interesting
because
point.
Me being concerned, knowing now how HIV is transmitted,
yeah.
and her not being told, the doctor saying that they're not going to tell her that she's infected with HIV, my first thought was, oh my God, what about the husband, the boyfriend, the partner? What about him?
Uh-huh.
I know it might make me unpopular, but I do believe before you accuse somebody of doing something that you really do need to make sure that you've crossed all your T's and dotted all your I's before you start pointing the finger. And I just can't help but think, it's 1984. Is he infected himself? You know, was he a one-night stand? Is this an unstable relationship? Did he fit the high-risk groups? You know, was he a drug user? Was he bisexual? I mean, I don't mean to sound harsh or horrible, but these are questions I'd be asking myself before laying blame solely with one person, which in this case is Christopher.
That's a fair point. And what do we learn about the two men mentioned in that article?
Well, in the case of the 40-year-old man that they mentioned, he was, as far as I'm aware, never publicly identified. But given the health authority identified him as having received what they termed whole blood from Chris's donation in March 1984, they state in the same document submitted as evidence to the Infected Blood Inquiry, BPLL00016023, quote, "Donation March 1984. Red cells transfused at end of March, early April, to male with bleeding peptic ulcer. Presented at beginning of November 1984 with an allergic rash. Found to be antibody HIV positive. Sexual contact, antibody HIV negative as of November 1984. In the case of the second man, 78-year-old Mr. Sidney Reuter, whose son was about to expose something truly concerning, and he does so in various newspapers up and down the country.
Really?
Like the Hartlepool Daily Mail on the 20th of February 1985, who run the headline, AIDS Death Blunder, with the strapline, "Hospital Cover-Up, Says Son."
I have a feeling this is two stories rolled into one.
Well, let's find out, because the article states, "Health chiefs have admitted an, quote, unfortunate blunder in which a pensioner's death was wrongly attributed to AIDS. Wessex Health Authority said last night there was a regrettable error on the death certificate of the former dock worker, Mr. Sidney Reuter, 78.
Oh, that's quite a U-turn.
Earlier, an inquest at Portsmouth, was told that bronchopneumonia with AIDS as a contributing factor was the cause of death. But last night, Mr. Reuter's son insisted that his father was an AIDS victim and claimed the, quote, error statement was a cover-up. Mr. Reuter, who has 5 grandchildren, was not a homosexual. The inquest was told he received contaminated blood in a transfusion during an operation at St. Mary's Hospital, Portsmouth, almost 2 years ago. The health authority said Mr. Reuter, from Cosham near Portsmouth, did not die from AIDS or anything related to it. But he had developed the AIDS antibody in his blood, as many other people have, and this was discovered after he died at St. Mary's on Sunday. But Mr. Reuter's son, who does not want to be named to protect his own children, said, quote, my dad had AIDS, and now the hospital is covering it up. I have been trying to find out for 3 months what was wrong with my father. I have been led up one garden path after another. His father had been told in October last year that he might have cancer, but when he was admitted to hospital, it was to an isolation ward. He refused to accept his father was dying of cancer, and doctors told him tests showed no signs of the condition. His suspicions were aroused when he was told not to let his 6-year-old son go near him. Quote, then one day they asked me if I had ever come into contact with my father's blood. I said that either my brother or myself might have touched some if he had cut himself shaving. We were immediately tested to see if we had picked up AIDS. Mr. Reuter's inquest was adjourned until a date to be fixed.
This is a bizarre stance for the health authority to take. But was it a cover-up, or did they believe it was a, quote, unfortunate blunder?
Well, the detail is back in that inquiry document that was submitted as evidence, BPLL006023, where it states, donation September 1983. Male, aged 77 years, underwent resection for benign prostate enlargement. Transfused at the end of September 1983. Re-seen November 1984, cancer of bowel. Found to be antibody HIV positive.
Odd behaviour.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they're saying that Mr. Reuter tested positive for HIV antibodies.
Yeah.
But I think they're trying to say that his bronchopneumonia was not classed as AIDS-related. But I did briefly speak to Mr. Reuter's granddaughter, and she shared Sydney, who was affectionately known within the family as Pops. And long after Sydney's death, the government started-ish to recognise those who had been affected by contaminated blood. And Sydney's granddaughter shared that she recalls her father and uncle, the sons of Sydney, received an element of compensation. So that's the 3 people who received whole blood or plasma through Chris's donations.
And I see in the Journal newspaper on January 22nd, 1985, that Chris is well enough to be discharged from hospital.
Yes, and it reads, AIDS man home. An AIDS victim who caused a scare after it was discovered his blood had been used in transfusions has been discharged from hospital. The Bournemouth man has been asked not to donate any more blood and to avoid sexual relations.
Ugh, isn't that a slight oxymoron? Victim and cause.
It's the start of the blame game, really, isn't it? But
yeah.
I suspect it's a little restrained because, as I said earlier, there was this belief that not all HIV antibody positive individuals would develop what they would term full-blown AIDS.
Okay.
And in some of the reports, the health authority repeatedly stated the risk was, quote, minimal to developing full-blown AIDS.
Really?
To haemophiliacs that had received this contaminating batch.
The next story to break is in the Evening Echo on February 20th, 1985, where the headline reads, local donor has killer virus, 40 traced in AIDS alert.
That's right, and the article reads, more than 40 people were given blood from a man who is now seriously ill with the killer virus AIDS in Bournemouth Royal National Hospital, it was revealed today. All the recipients have been traced. 4 are from Dorset. They are haemophiliacs who were treated at Dorchester. None are from Bournemouth. It is now known that one of the recipients, a 78-year-old former dock worker who died on Sunday, was not suffering from AIDS. We know this not to be true, but... Health chiefs have admitted an unfortunate blunder in which AIDS was wrongly shown as a contributory factor on the death certificate of Mr. Sidney Reuter from Portsmouth. Now is not the time for either complacency or alarm.
Huh.
The health service is not being complacent and people facing transfusions should not be alarmed. We are discouraging people in the high-risk groups from donating blood, he added.
Only 4 weeks after being released from Bournemouth's Royal National Hospital, Christopher is back.
Yes, after spending 4 months on their isolation ward from October 1984 to January 1985, his stay this time on being readmitted is sadly short. After only days of being readmitted, Christopher John Charles Egner, aged 27, passed away on the 22nd of February 1985.
So young.
Born in Hull, North Yorkshire, on the 4th of May 1957, Christopher's occupation is listed upon his death certificate as office manager, and his father, John Egner, registers his death on the day his son passed away. Christopher's cause of death is recorded as 1A, cryptococcal meningitis, the very same as John Lewis in the previous episode, as it was a common form of AIDS-related meningitis, and 1B, pneumocystis carinii pneumonia, known as PCP, and again, a common AIDS-related form of pneumonia.
27. Incredibly young. And I assume the newspapers went crazy the days after Christopher's death.
Indeed, although they didn't wait days, they did it the very same day that Chris died. His death is reported in every newspaper up and down the country, although they do not name him. Many run the same headline, AIDS blood donor dies, like that from London's Evening Standard. Mm. But the Liverpool Echo went with the headline, Donor Dies of AIDS, and it states, a blood donor who had given blood to at least 41 people died today from the disease AIDS in a Bournemouth hospital. The man, in his 20s, had been in isolation since being admitted to the hospital in October. Not quite true. Wessex Regional Health Authority said it had traced 41 patients who had received blood donated by the man and they were being monitored regularly. 38 of the patients, including a 2-year-old boy from Portsmouth, were haemophiliacs who had received the clotting agent factor 8, said the authority. They have been found to have AIDS antibodies, but it is highly unlikely they will actually get the disease, said a spokesman.
You know, science is a wonderful thing. And of course, with time comes a greater understanding. And we know the advice changed, the treatments changed, and eventually the prognosis changed. But it's hard to believe that this is their scientific belief.
I think what makes it difficult to comprehend today is the fact that in 1985, there was so much fear and stigma. I mean, this is widely documented, but it's hard to get your head around this quite casual and laid-back attitude. And I think that they not only genuinely believed it, but I think that this is how they interpreted the science or understood the science.
Yeah.
Because when you think, really, they've not necessarily been able to monitor how the virus attacked the body from the date of infection to the date of decline, because, as we know, HIV left untreated on average takes 8 to 10 years to result in AIDS-related complications or even an AIDS-related death.
The Poole Evening Echo, on the day Chris passed away, reported the story on their front page.
Yes, and interestingly, it's only a small box article which reads, AIDS man dies. A man in his 20s died today from AIDS disease in the Royal National Hospital, Bournemouth, said a spokesman for a Wessex Regional Health Authority. That's it, the end.
But there's also a separate AIDS-related article on the front page of the Echo.
That's right, because if you just literally swish your eyes to the right, you'll see, under a photo of Dr. Pinchin, a consultant in immunology of St. Mary's Hospital, London, and is often cited in articles or appeared on TV as the go-to AIDS doctor, it states, AIDS test pledge, page 3. And the article on page 3 has the headline, blood donors will undergo AIDS tests.
Okay.
Above the headline is a photograph of a panel of 5 doctors, including Dr. Pinchin, and the article reads, all Wessex blood donors will undergo AIDS tests before the end of the year, said a doctor at a Bournemouth conference on the killer disease. Tests are being developed to detect the potentially deadly virus in blood samples, said Dr. John Smith of Wessex Blood Transfusion Service. An accurate test should be available later in the year, when all donors will have to undergo screening, said Dr. Smith. The pledge to develop a test comes after 41 people, most of them haemophiliacs, received contaminated blood from a man who is dying of AIDS in Bournemouth's Royal National Hospital.
Is dying from AIDS? The newspaper hasn't made the connection from the article on the front page that, sadly, Chris has already passed away.
Maybe that explains why the article was short, and not to forget, the health authority had not yet published his name, so perhaps they are reporting with caution.
But did all this talk of extra measures around blood donations only come about from Chris's story?
You want the short answer?
Go on.
No, is the answer. Because, given America was around 3 years ahead.
Hang on, hang on. As a proud American, I think you should rephrase that to, given Great Britain was 3 years behind.
No, actually, I agree with you there. You're right. Right, right. Cut that. We'll do it again. Right, you ready? Because given the UK was around 3 years behind America, there were concerns from the early 1980s over the import of contaminated factor VIII used to treat haemophilia. Then, in February and March 1984, the press reported concerns that were being raised with contaminated blood products, mainly factor VIII, and mainly from the United States, as the UK didn't have the capacity to process its own factor VIII. So much so, the national newspaper, Mail on Sunday, found themselves in hot water, as the Observer reported on the 18th of March 1984. And under the headline, Mail Censored, the article states, an article in the Mail on Sunday unacceptably sensationalised the risk of contracting the AIDS disease from blood transfusions imported from America, according to a Press Council adjudication. Under the headline, Hospitals Using Colour Blood, the article used extravagant and alarmist terms which were not justified by the evidence contained in it or provided since, the council says today. The council partly upheld a complaint from Mr. Peter Jones, director of the Northern Region Haemophilia Service in Newcastle-upon-Tyne, that the newspaper published an exaggerated story about blood transfusion supplies causing needless distress and suffering, especially to haemophiliacs. The editor of the Mail on Sunday, Mr. Stewart, told the council that his newspaper was proud of its contribution to the understanding of a terrible malady. The council adds that the subject was a proper one for the newspaper inquiry and report.
I hate to say it, but...
The Mail on Sunday only reported what we now know to be true, retrospectively. And it's really heartbreakingly sad that this complaint only came about and came from the regional director of the haemophilia network up north. So, you know, it's really sad because they really just were saying what turned out to be true. But I only mention this article because it shows it was of concern. Contaminated blood products were of concern as early as March 1984. Although the Infected Blood Inquiry in their ruling did find that there was, I think, 2 or 3 years before, there was concerns over HIV AIDS contaminating blood, and decades before that, hepatitis. Wow. So, you know, it was of concern. So in answer to your question, did this all come about because of Chris Egner's passing away? No, it was already there. It was already going on. Uh-huh. Just nobody was really willing to address it or speak about it, apart from the Mail on Sunday. And also to demonstrate that Chris wasn't a first by any means whatsoever, if we rewind slightly, he goes into hospital at the beginning of October 1984. They suspect that he's got an AIDS diagnosis. The doctors ask Chris, have you donated blood? He says yes. They trace his donations. They recall the factor VIII that's been produced from a pool of other donors. And the story breaks in the news on the 20th of December 1984. Now, there's an interesting article on the 21st of December 1984 in the Daily Telegraph, where the headline reads, AIDS blood given to 40 patients. Now, the article starts off with a lot of the insight that we already know, that we've already covered and spoken about.
Okay.
But before we go any further, let's test your knowledge on haemophilia and the production of this clotting agent, factor VIII. So, when you're ready. Gloria, how many blood donors does it take to make a batch of the clotting agent factor VIII?
Okay, so donors plural means it takes more than one donor. Two?
Is that your final answer?
Four.
Is that your final answer? Wink, wink, wink.
10? It can't be more than 10.
Well, I'm sorry, I'm not giving you any lifelines whatsoever, so do you give in? Is that your final answer?
Yes, let's put it to the listeners.
You mean ask the audience. Let's ask the audience.
What's the answer?
Okay, so the answer is widely verified across many reputable sites across the internet. Even in the Infected Blood Inquiry, they have documents online talking about pooling and the production of factor VIII in the UK. But the Haemophilia Society state, factor concentrate was produced by pooling human blood plasma from up to, you ready?
Yeah.
40,000 donors and concentrating it to extract the required clotting factor.
40,000! That's incredible. I would never have guessed it took that many separate donors to make factor VIII.
Me too.
Wow.
Just one contaminated sample could infect the entire batch. And as I say, I saw documents submitted as evidence to the Infected Blood Inquiry talking about pooling of donations, both in the 70s in regards to hepatitis and then into the 80s in regards to hepatitis and HIV AIDS. I remember one document that said that a small pool of donations was considered to be 1,000 donors.
No way.
And I regularly saw documents that were talking about pool sizes of 22,500 people.
Really?
How many of those would have been either aware of the HIV AIDS status or would have been infected with HIV and AIDS? It's out of 22,500 people, it's got to be more than one.
Good point.
So I think it's really bad to blame one person.
Yeah.
And in regards to Chris's donation, because it's only one batch that, you know, Chris is associated with as being a donor that was in a pool of other donors.
But given we now know the presence of AIDS was high in 1983, 84, and 85, surely Chris was not the only donor out of thousands that were pulled in this batch to be HIV positive.
This batch, HL3186, in some of the communications when they're recalling it, I can't remember who, but in one document, one doctor or one individual was suggesting that when the product is recalled and brought back, not to destroy it. They actually suggest that they want to heat treat it so it can go out, because plasma at this time was actually referred to as liquid gold because it was so expensive. And obviously, the bigger the batch, if you can destroy a big batch, you are losing shitloads of money, time and effort. So I do get a feeling that this was, you know, a reasonably sized batch. It wasn't small.
Yeah.
Perhaps it wasn't on the side of 40,000, but still, they're not wanting to destroy it. I mean, yes, it is possible he was the only one, but I think it's highly unlikely.
I agree.
For what we are about to learn in the Daily Telegraph article, which reads, tests on a further 16 patients in Edinburgh have shown that they are also carrying antibodies to the virus which causes AIDS as a result of being treated with contaminated blood from a different donor. The outbreaks indicate that Britain has lost the battle to prevent the AIDS virus infiltrating blood supplies used both for transfusions and for the production of factor VIII, a substance used for the treatment of haemophiliacs. And in regards to Christopher's donation to the pool of 39,999 other donors, this article states, Mr. David Waters, coordinator of the Haemophilia Society, said that NHS blood supplies could no longer be regarded as safe and called on the government to pay the £7 million cost of importing heat-treated supplies of factor VIII, which would give haemophiliacs protection. The alarm was raised after it was found that a Bournemouth man, Chris, being treated for AIDS, had donated blood in September 1983 and in March of this year, 1984. His blood was used for transfusions to a pregnant woman from the Birmingham area and two men, one middle-aged and one 78, both from Portsmouth. Investigations by Wessex Regional Blood Transfusion Centre showed that the rest of the blood was used to manufacture the clotting agent factor VIII. It was given to 29 haemophiliacs in the area and to a further 9 patients in Wales. So that makes it 38 haemophiliacs in total.
Okay.
All of the patients have been contacted and are now being regularly monitored for signs of the disease, which can take up to 2 years to develop. Mr. Donald Smith, director of the Wessex Centre, said, quote, many of these haemophiliac patients had already been exposed to AIDS antibodies as a result of previous treatment, and there is no sign that any of them has developed clinical AIDS as a result of the contaminated donations.
What?
Mm-hmm.
Say that bit again.
Which bit?
That last bit. I want to hear it again.
Mr. Donald Smith, director of the Wessex Centre, said many of these haemophiliac patients had already been exposed to AIDS antibodies as a result of previous treatment, and there is no sign that any of them has developed clinical AIDS as a result of the contaminated donations.
Oh, man.
Look, I know you will agree there are no winners in any of this. It is all incredibly tragic for all involved, but I think the articles on Chris, and we've only read a couple, all the others are on the Extra Tea blog, link in the show notes, but the reporting would have you believe that Chris's blood donation was responsible for infecting 39 haemophiliacs when, as the director of the Wessex Blood Transfusion Service states, quote, many, sadly not just one, not a couple, not even a few, but many patients that received factor VIII from batch HL3186 had already tested positive for AIDS antibodies from contaminated Factor VIII they'd received previously from another batch pulled from another 40,000 donors that didn't include Chris Egnor.
And that contaminated blood products were being administered before Chris's donation.
Exactly. And in that document that we referred to earlier, BPLL001603, that was submitted to the Infected Blood Inquiry, we see some very interesting follow-up testing data from those haemophiliacs, those patients that had been treated with this contaminated batch, HL3186, where Chris's blood or plasma donation was pooled with many other donations. Now, we can't say for certain if it was 40,000 donations. That information isn't available.
Okay.
But even if we just go with the lower estimates of 1,000 donations, that's still 999 donations too many in my view. And this first set of numbers that appear in this document are from people who, before receiving this contaminated batch, HL3186, they have somewhat confirmed HIV tests, so they know their status before they receive this batch. Four people were already HIV positive before they received this batch. HL3186, they were already HIV positive. Four people. Eight people before receiving this batch had HIV tests that were negative. However, after receiving this batch, two people became HIV positive. The other six remained HIV negative 6 months after being in receipt of this batch.
That's interesting.
Now, I'm no expert, I'm no clinician, I'm no expert, but you know, I know the guidelines is, you know, if you've had a possible risk of infection, you've got to wait up to 3 months before it will show on a test. If it's not showing on a test 6 months after, I think we're probably in a pretty good safe zone.
Yeah.
But we have to remember as well, 1985, testing really wasn't that great, wasn't that accurate. So four people were already HIV positive before they received this batch that Chris was pulled in, and out of eight people that had a test prior to being in receipt of this batch that was HIV negative, only two of them have become HIV positive. Whether that's Chris's batch or not, we'll never know.
Does this confirm HL3186 has passed HIV to two people?
Well, not entirely, because those involved at the time and in the inquiry note some haemophiliac patients, depending on the severity of their haemophilia, will have received other factor VIII products. And, you know, and some, they say, would need injections up to 3 times a week. So it could have been any number of other injections or any other number of batches. It's hard to point the finger, really, because just because a batch isn't identified as being contaminated doesn't mean that it isn't contaminated. Because it would have taken somebody like Chris to present with symptoms of HIV/AIDS, to go to hospital feeling unwell, answer truthfully the question of the doctor, have you given blood? If the doctor's asked the patient that at all. In this case, the doctor asked Chris if he'd given blood. He said, yes, I have. And they were able to trace and recall the product. But I'm sure there's thousands of other people that didn't fall ill or didn't go into hospital or weren't honest about whether they'd given blood or not. And batches went untraced. So I think when you look back retrospectively, you can't say that every single batch that wasn't identified as being contaminated wasn't contaminated.
And like those at the inquiry, Chris's untimely death had an effect on those who loved him, his family, his friends.
Yes, because on the 22nd of February 1985, the Bournemouth Evening Echo state Chris's sister and mother are, quote, too distraught to comment on his death. And they go on to quote Chris's mother, quote, we are just too distressed. I mean, oh gosh, leave the family alone. And Chris's friend, Reverend Dick Jones, visited Chris in hospital and is quoted as saying Chris bore his illness, quote, with great courage, and that Chris was a talented organist, quote, a nice young man, outgoing, and with a great interest in church music. And then on the 25th of February 1985, in the Hull Daily Mail, a series of family tributes, which read, Christopher John Egnor, February 22nd, age 27. Dearly loved only son of Diana and Jack. Loving brother of Carol, Jill and Jackie. Peace after a long illness, patiently borne. God bless you, Chris. Sorrowing mum and dad, private family funeral. Chris Egnor. Peace after much suffering. Treasured memories of my dearest brother will never fade. Love, Carol and Colin. Night, night, God bless Uncle Chris. We didn't see you often, but loved you just the same. Love, Victoria and Elizabeth. Chris Egnor. Much loved brother who will be sadly missed. God bless Chris. loved and remembered forever, Jill and Martin. Christopher Egner, dearly loved nephew of Gladys and Rosamond, cousin to Wendy and Paul, peace after much suffering. Chris Egner, dear brother of Jackie, in-law David, sleep peacefully, Chris. We will never forget you. Chris Egner, you have found your peace at last, Chris. Our love and support to family, Betty and Glyn. I mean, it's clear that Chris is much loved, yeah, and has many family and friends, because the tributes continue the following day in the Hull Daily Mail.
And on Friday, March 1st, 1985, the Hull Daily Mail report the news of the funeral that took place under the headline, Funeral of AIDS Victim. Cottingham AIDS victim Christopher Egner, 27, was cremated at a private ceremony in Bournemouth today. His parents, who traveled to the South Coast for the service, were joined by Mr. Egner's friends at the resort's Stroudon Avenue Crematorium. His three sisters were also present. The Anglican Rural Dean of Bournemouth, Canon David Haslam, said Mr. Egner was a kind, sensitive, and humorous man.
Oh, and you'd hope that the press would stop there.
And they don't?
Sadly not, because around 7 months later, the Bournemouth Evening Echo run the front page headline, AIDS Victim Linked to Boy 9. And the article reads, a 9-year-old Hampshire boy who has AIDS antibodies in his blood received blood products from Bournemouth AIDS victim Mr. Christopher Egner. It was confirmed today. A spokesman for Wessex Health Authority said the lad from Chandler's Ford is one of about 30 haemophiliacs in the region who were treated with products from the blood of Mr. Egner, who died from AIDS in March this year. Other recipients of products from his blood have been traced and have been monitored, the spokesman said. Dr. Terry Hamblin, consultant haematologist at Boscombe Hospital, where there is a haemophilia centre, pointed out today that 60% of severe haemophiliacs in this country who have been receiving long-term injections of blood clotting agent factor 8 are known to have AIDS antibodies in their bloodstreams. However, the chance that they would develop AIDS was slight, and only 3 of them were known to have the disease. He added that he thought it was unlikely that a definite link could be established between the antibodies in the blood of the Chandler's Ford child and Mr. Egner. Oh, completely agree. Since most haemophiliacs receive factor 8 from a number of sources, quote, this lad could have received it from all over the world, he pointed out.
Oh, absolutely.
The press just never quit, do they? But you mentioned the contaminated blood inquiry. What did they conclude in their final report?
Well, the final report from the inquiry was delivered by Sir Brian Langstaff on the 21st of May 2024. And he, in his findings, firmly laid the blame with the government of the United Kingdom. So let's just take a listen.
Is that if we had followed the World Health Organization's advice, there would have been fewer infections from blood and from blood products and fewer deaths. As for pool sizes, the dangers of pooling plasma from many donors were established by the Medical Research Council in 1944. The greater the number of donors to a pool, the greater the risk from it, because one infected donation could contaminate the whole pool. In 1951, the textbook that was then the Bible of blood transfusion said, the use of large pool plasma has, of course, been abandoned. The use of only small pools lasted until after 1970. Then, however, something extraordinary happened. Just as the long-term seriousness of hepatitis became more and more apparent, the size of pools used to make UK blood products grew ever larger and larger. And with that, so too did the risk. Instead of reducing the risk, the UK was steadily increasing it. Blood donors in the UK gave blood freely, purely for the good of other people unknown to them, and they deserve praise for that. By contrast, the blood supplied in the United States was largely sold by people who needed the money. And until such time as direct tests specific to hepatitis C and HIV were available. A further way of reducing the chances that hepatitis C or HIV would get into the blood supply and be transfused was to test for certain markers in the blood which could help identify the donations that might be infected. This was known as surrogate testing. The opportunity of this surrogate testing in the case of HIV was lost. In respect of hepatitis C, taking a decision about it was put off, and then delayed until it was simply too late. In the cases of each of the viruses, in case of HIV, a test had been developed by August 1984. But it was not introduced for the screening of blood donations until October 1985. It takes time to produce such a test in sufficient quantity to screen all blood donations and to check its reliability, but I have concluded that we lost months for no clear reason by delays and indecision when setting up a process to evaluate each available make of test. Yet a number were commercially available and being used elsewhere in the world. Patients receiving transfusions in the UK were needlessly exposed to the risk of HIV as a result. A number of failures contributed to the infection of so many with bleeding disorders. Failing to plan sufficiently to produce enough blood products, with the UK having to rely on, to avoid the UK having to rely on experts, or on imports, I'm sorry, to a failure to achieve self-sufficiency, which though it became government policy, was not delivered to the end of the 1980s. Failing to suspend imports in mid-1983, continuing importations of products made from plasma collected before safety measures were adopted in the USA, and being slow to adopt and develop heat-treated blood products in which HIV had been inactivated and neutralized. A real risk that blood products transmitted the cause of AIDS was known by government in July 1982. It was known by all haemophilia doctors by the end of 1982. There was already a growing epidemic in the United States likely to come to these shores, yet the response here was one of denial, disbelief, dismissiveness, and delay. The government's response was unconscionably slow. So too was the response of Haemophilia Centre directors and of their organization, the UK HCDO. Professor Arthur Bloom was chairman of the Haemophilia Directors, and he died many years ago. He must bear some of the responsibility for the UK's slowness in responding to the risks of AIDS to people with haemophilia. In May 1983, the Mail on Sunday put "hospitals using killer blood" on their front page. We in the Inquiry now believe that one of the sources for that story was Professor Bloom's respected senior colleague in Cardiff, who was reluctant at the time to be identified as a whistleblower. Professor Bloom told the Haemophilia Society that, in spite of inaccurate statements in the press, he was unaware of any proven case in the UK and there was no need to change their treatment. The Haemophilia Society then relayed his advice to their members. Yet he, Professor Bloom, himself, was treating a patient he believed had AIDS. He reported as much to the UK Centre for Disease Surveillance. He was a member of the various committees involved in the response to AIDS, and disastrously, the Department of Health and Social Security was over-influenced by his advice. In particular, his advice to continue importing commercial factor concentrates, where the leading epidemiologist and head of the Communicable Disease Surveillance Centre, Dr. Spence Galbraith, had advised against it. Inexplicably, no government minister was shown the epidemiological advice to suspend imports until the risk of AIDS was better understood. The decision taken in July 1983, not to suspend them, was a bad one for a number of reasons. All the evidence points to a single inescapable conclusion that children and adults were not treated in a way which prioritized their safety above other considerations. These failures were widespread. They were wrong. They were unethical. The failures in decision-making that led to the original infections were then compounded by institutional defensiveness. And that's a pattern of institutional defensiveness that must stop. When citizens have concerns that something has gone seriously wrong, fairness should mean that they get answers. People infected with blood and blood products did not. Instead, their trauma has been compounded by the lack of recognition of what happened to them and by a lack of accountability. The report details how three lines were repeatedly deployed by successive governments: that people had the best available treatment, that the infections were inadvertent, and that screening for hepatitis C could not have been introduced earlier than September 1991. All of those claims were untrue. At the start of the inquiry, people told me they wanted to ensure that a disaster like this never happened again. The report begins to address that by setting out a number of lessons to be learned. The first and most important lesson to be learned is that patient safety must be the guiding principle. Many, indeed most, infections would have been prevented if patient safety had been paramount throughout. The second lesson to be learned concerns risk. Risk was poorly understood and poorly communicated, and the wrong questions were asked and answered. The line that there was no conclusive proof that AIDS had been transmitted by blood and blood products may have been strictly true at the time, but it was misleading and it misled. It gave false comfort to patients and clinicians that the risks were not as real as indeed they were. The public should be trusted with the truth, with all its uncertainties. Professor Arthur Bloom, to return to him in this context, was warned in a letter from the US Centers of Disease Control in March 1983 that AIDS was an epidemic evolving, quote, with a frightening pace, close quotes, and that blood products could transmit its cause. He failed to share that letter or the information within it. Instead, some clinicians advised that the small number of cases meant that it was not a big risk for the UK haemophilia population. Now, that confused incidence and risk. In a disease with an incubation period of some 2 years, the cases you diagnose on day one only tell you who was infected 2 years ago. Not who is infected today, but has not yet been diagnosed. The day cases showing today are just the tip of the iceberg. In their slow and protracted decision-making, civil servants and ministers lost sight of the value of taking steps to reduce risk, even if full elimination was not yet possible. Infections could have been prevented, and lives could have been saved, even if just some of the measures examined in the report had been implemented. And if patient safety were the guiding principle, there should have been curiosity before 2017 about what led over 3,000 people to die and thousands more to live with infections. Apart from lessons which should be learned, what else should happen next? Well, I fully expect the government to make an apology. To be meaningful, though, that apology must explain what the apology is for. It should recognize and acknowledge not just the suffering, but the fact that the suffering was the result of errors, wrongs done, and delays incurred. It should provide vindication to those who have waited for that for so long. Finally, I'd like to thank again all of you here for your contribution to this inquiry. Whatever your perspective has been, the sheer numbers here pay testament to the importance of the issues this inquiry has been considering. And it pays tribute to the interest and engagement which you have shown, which has never flagged since the days when so many of you came to the preliminary hearing. An inquiry serves its purpose best when everyone involved, from whatever perspective, participates, as you have done. But I would like to thank, too, those who have contributed, who would be here, but can no longer be. Too many are too seriously ill as a result of their infections. Too many have died. I will mention one person, but everyone here knows of others who've not survived to hear the outcome of this inquiry. You don't need me to tell you more people die each week. Imagine the difference it would have made if this inquiry had been held 30 years ago.
If people... Justice now! Justice now!
If people were given answers then and had recognition of their losses so they could have lived the rest of their lives free from financial hardship without having to fight for justice and recognition. It may be late, but it's not too late. Now is the time, finally, for national recognition of this disaster, for proper compensation, and for vindication for all those who have been so terribly wronged.
All of the actual newspaper articles mentioned in this serving are available on the Extra Tea blog. You can find the link below in the show notes. If you've enjoyed listening to AIDS, The Lost Voices, then don't be a shady bitch and show us some love with
a big fat like,
a comment,
a share, as in the link, not as in do you believe in life after love, oh.
And for fuck's sake, don't forget to
subscribe and follow.